Some years ago, when my boys were little enough for me to hold them up on my shoulders, we went to a Civil War battle reenactment, and my younger son Ben, who was up on my shoulders at the time, said, "Daddy, who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys?" And I looked around, and several other spectators were looking at me expectantly, and I laughed, and I said, "Well, Ben, it depends on whom you ask." And, of course, the spectators laughed appreciatively, and I avoided what might have been an unpleasant circumstance. Similarly, if you ask anyone what caused the American Civil War, you're liable to get at least a couple of different answers. And so it's the case today when I speak with James Loewen, an award-winning author, and Donnie Kennedy, who's also written about the Civil War. And I ask each of these gentlemen, what caused the war? Wait and see what they say.
Your weekly Constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
There have been many constitutional crises in the last 200-some-odd years in this country, but on only one occasion, did we actually have a war over them. And of course, the issue, the constitutional issue in that case was slavery, or perhaps it was secession, or perhaps it was both. It really depends upon whom you ask. And today, I have two authors with me. I have James Loewen, who has written a book called The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader. And he has some pretty strong opinions on the subject. We'll be hearing from him in a little while. First, we'll be speaking to another author. His name is Donnie Kennedy, and he's written a book that has a very provocative title. He called it The South Was Right. Welcome, Donnie.
Good afternoon to you. I hope it's a nice, sunny Dixie day where you are. It's beautiful here in Louisiana.
It is beautiful Dixie day here in East Tennessee. You've written a book that says the South was right. Do you believe, then, the South was justified in firing upon Fort Sumter?
Definitely on fire on Fort Sumter, but the South was right. The meaning of that title is that South was constitutionally correct in seceding. Secession was a constitutional, it is an American way, it is not un-American, it is the thing to do when the people of a sovereign state decide that they can no longer trust the government that they're in. So we're not saying the argument is, from our point of view, strictly constitutional. Is secession correct? Yes, it is. The South was correct in what it did. Now, you may say it seceded for the wrong reason. Well, okay, but it still does not nullify the act of secession. Secession is a constitutional thing to do. Have you ever heard of the textbook by William Rawl? It was used at West Point Military Academy. It was the first textbook on the U.S. Constitution, and it was used at West Point Military Academy. And William Rawl was a friend of Washington and Franklin, and he was an abolitionist. But yet, in the 31st chapter of his textbook, it's called Of the Union. He describes how a state would legally go about seceding from the Union. Now, this textbook was reviewed by the North American Review 1 year after its publication. The North American Review was in Boston, Massachusetts. They gave it a glowing review and said it was a safe and intelligent guide to understand the Constitution. But yet, in 1825, when this book was published and when it was reviewed, everybody seemed to understand that, yes, sovereign states have the right to secede. They freely went into the Union. They can freely come out of the Union. And that's the emphasis of the book, The South Was Right. That's what we're looking at. And we're also looking at the consequences to America today as a result of the loss of that war and then the loss of real states' rights, as William Rawl described it in his book, A View of the Constitution.
Okay, so when you say the South was right, you're not defending slavery.
Absolutely not.
You're simply saying that secession is something that's constitutional.
Absolutely.
Okay, but before we go on, you mentioned, of course, also states' rights. So
right. You
think this was also the Southern War of Independence, as you called it, or the Civil War, as it's more commonly known, was something that was a matter of simply asserting states' rights?
The right of a state, of the sovereign state, to withdraw from the Union, yes. Any state, it could be the state of Massachusetts. They have a right to do the only... Or it's the question of who is supreme in this case. Do we have federal supremacy, or do we have the supremacy of the people at the local level, i.e. states' rights? where does sovereignty really reside? I've always believed, as did William Rawl, as did St. George Tucker, as did many other notable Americans, that sovereignty resides with we the people of the sovereign state. Well, look at your Constitution. The first paragraph says, all powers herein granted is vested.
But the Constitution also says in Article 6 that federal law is supreme and that every...
Ah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Even John C. Calhoun would agree with you there.
Mm-hmm.
As long as that law is pursuant to the Constitution. The difference between people who believe in federal supremacy and people like myself... People who believe in federal supremacy, absolute federal supremacy, say that anything the federal government lays its hands on, it is supreme in that endeavor. Whereas I say only in those areas in which they are pursuant of the Constitution. And if you don't believe me, check Alexander Hamilton. And
well, that's fine. But what had the federal government done prior to 1860 that was not pursuant to the Constitution?
Well, now here again, are you going to say that the only right? The only way a man can exercise his right is if he is absolutely proven to be correct in his ill will or feelings of being abused. So who is going to be the judge of whether or not the state of Virginia felt like it was being abused? Will it be the federal government or will it be the people of Virginia? Now, the people of Virginia may say we are being abused and we are seceding, and they may be incorrect. But nevertheless, it is they, the people of the state of Virginia, and they only who have the right to determine how they shall be governed.
Well, the first three words of the Constitution, as you know, say, we the people of the United States.
Now, wait a minute. I believe we're talking about the preamble.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's in Jacobson versus Massachusetts in 1906. Even the Supreme Court of the United States tells us that no preamble of any document can be used to void an article or a section of that document. That's plain international law. I mean, they didn't make this up in 1906. That's international law. So that preamble is nothing but a salutation. Good morning, sir. How are you? That's all that is.
Well, now, there are some other constitutional cases out there.
Now, who made the Constitution? Who made it? Let's go to Article 7, and we clearly see who made it. It's not we the people in the aggregate. Not at all. It's not some democratic plebiscite by the American people. Who is it? It's the sovereign will of we the people of the sovereign states. Only 9 states was needed to ratify the Constitution. What happened to the other states? Were they compelled by force of arms to join the Union? No. They had a right to judge from themselves when and if they were to join the Union. And why? Because they were sovereign people in a sovereign state, i.e., they were free people. They knew that if you cannot leave, you are not free.
Well, I understand that. But your arguments all seem to be coming back to this idea of sovereignty and the idea that the people of a given state are the ultimate sovereigns and they're determining their own political power.
That's correct.
But isn't that a difficult argument to make when a significant proportion of those people is enslaved? I mean, I think in South Carolina, close to half the population was enslaved. So how can you say that those people were represented in those decisions?
Good, excellent point. So now we're going to say the Confederacy is an illegitimate government because all 13 Confederate states had slaves in them. Is that what you're saying? If that's what you're saying, look at the United States flag. There's 13 stripes on that flag. Those stripes represent 13 slave-holding colonies that were states of the United States. Even Massachusetts had slaves. And those states that had the fewest number of slaves were the ones that were the heaviestly involved in the African slave trade.
Oh, I know
so
that.
Now you're making the United States just as illegitimate as you would make the Confederate States.
Well, a lot of people in Britain made such arguments back during
Absolutely.
Our revolution. But by 1860, and of course we're talking about the causes of our American Civil War, by 1860 slavery had been largely abolished in the northern states, not completely, and I'm certainly not arguing that the North had completely clean hands in this, in fact, far from it. But at that point, most of the North was free, and the South was pretty solidly slave. And so doesn't that tend to undercut most arguments about states' rights and sovereignty when the Southern states...
Not at all. Not at all. Because, like I said, go back to the argument. If you say it makes the Confederacy illegitimate, it also makes the United States illegitimate. Now, you're saying that in 1860 there were slaves here. Do you know that in 1833 in Mississippi, Governor Brandon of Mississippi was talking about how Mississippi could go about with ending slavery? In the same time frame, Virginia came within 3 or 4 votes of adopting a system of gradual emancipation. Slavery is not something that's going to last forever. Anybody that has got a half-wit of a brain knows why slavery existed. It existed for the advantage of labor. With the mechanical advantage of the internal combustion engine, slavery would have been too expensive to maintain. It would have died out naturally. It had a natural ending coming. So, you know, if you're going to say, well, you Southerners in 1860 owned slaves, and you probably owned slaves in 2000 if we'd let you go, that's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. None of my grandparents owned, great-grandparents owned slaves, and they all were Confederate soldiers. Now, do you think they're so dumb as to fight just so some rich Southern plantation owner could own slaves? It just doesn't make sense.
Hmm. Well, I see your point. But let's before we end here, and we're running out of time. One other thing,
you're having fun.
Oh, I'm having fun too. I'm glad. I'm glad to talk to you. In the actual documents that document the reasons for the Southern states seceding, slavery figures very prominently, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And
so
again,
I mean, shouldn't we look to those documents themselves when we ask why did the South mm-hmm. secede? Why did the Civil War occur?
All the time. Mm-hmm. I do it all the time. I know you think that's crazy, but I do.
Oh, I don't think it's crazy.
If you notice that that's not the only thing that's listed, if that was the only thing listed, you'd say, yeah, that's all they were. That was a bad reason to secede. But it would not nullify the right of secession, even at that. But if you notice, in Mississippi, for example, Mississippi, that's where I grew up, and I know more about Mississippi, but they listed that. Who were the ones who were drawing that document up? It was the Democrats in Mississippi who were the small farmers, non-slaveholders. What they were really trying to do in Mississippi was get the Delta plantation on with their millions of dollars to come on board, because they were Whigs, not Democrats, and the Whigs were opposed to secession. So, of course, they're going to mention slavery, trying to intrigue those slaveholders, big plantation owners, and big money people to come on board with this idea of secession, which after secession became a fact, that's exactly what the Whigs did. They didn't run back to the Republican Party and say, we're going to fight with the Republicans against these Democrats. But it was, as much as anything else, a political ploy by the Democrats. And remember, the Democrats are the small country people, not the big plantation owners, trying to get the Democrats trying to get the Whigs on board with this cause of secession because they needed their money. Wars take money. Establishing new government takes money. So that's one of the reasons that appeal to slavery is in there. So just because it's in there doesn't mean that everybody in the South was fighting to own a slave. As I said, none of my ancestors were slave owners. They had no hopes of being a slave owner. So, you know, it had to be more to it than just purely trying to promote and defend slavery, which, interestingly enough, the person who promoted the idea first and foremost was a guy in Europe by the name of Karl Marx. Did you know that? Interesting, isn't it?
Who promoted what?
The idea that the South was fighting to promote and extend slavery.
Well, that's interesting.
It is. Read my book, Lincoln's Marxist. You'll find out all about it.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I don't think that Abraham Lincoln ever quoted Karl Marx, though.
No, he didn't. But you know what? Abraham Lincoln had a lot of communist generals in his army. He also had a guy by the name of Charles A. Dana, who was, if not a communist, a fellow traveler, a close friend of Karl Marx and Frederick Engels. And he was Assistant Secretary of War under Stanton, and Lincoln called him the Eyes of the Army.
I see. So Lincoln the Red. I had no idea. Our subject today is what caused the Civil War. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll speak some more with Donnie Kennedy. Stay tuned. Well, it's time once again for the constitutional quiz, and with me in this studio is Doug Smith, the quiz guy. How you doing, Doug?
I'm doing great, Stuart. How are you?
I'm doing very well. So what's up today?
Oh, I've got a great quiz today.
Well, then, spit it out.
So I'm going to title this one, President's Packing.
President's Packing.
Yeah.
As in packing heat?
As in, who doesn't like a good duel?
Well, I always do. What do you got?
Okay. What 19th century U.S. president was shot at and actually hit multiple times before taking office? Was it A, John F. Kennedy? B, Andrew Jackson? C, James Madison? Or D, Aaron Burr?
Very interesting choices there. So this is people who were actually shot at and hit before they were president.
That's right, which means they must have survived when they get shot.
Yeah, I don't think we'd inaugurate a dead guy. Well, do we have a contestant on the line?
Yes, we do. I am Pedro Gonzalez from Fairfax County, Virginia.
From Fairfax County, all the way up there in Northern Virginia. Well, tremendous. Well, did you hear the question, Pedro?
Yes, I did.
Well, do you have any reaction?
Well, I thought it was going to be George Washington because I hear he usually wore his uniform riddled with bullet holes. But I think I'm going to go with Andrew Jackson because...
Andrew Jackson. Why do you think Andrew Jackson was shot and hit?
From what I hear, he was a man's man. He never really backed down and was not very liked.
Well, what about James Madison? I heard he's kind of a bad boy from time to time.
Madison fits me as the book type. He does a lot of writing.
James Madison.
He's a bad boy.
Pedro, don't let him do that to you.
I'm sorry.
James Madison, you know, he was the only president to actually fight in a war.
He was. He was commander-in-chief. He went out there and commanded the troops.
That's
okay,
right.
I mean, it's not too far-fetched. He's a bad boy.
Well, the problem is when he went to go beat back the British at Bladensburg, I think he had to ask someone for a gun.
Ah, okay. All right, well then, how did Pedro do?
Well, he did great. It's the man's man. It's the people's president is what he was called, of course. It was Andrew Jackson. He's said to have been in over 100 duels, usually around honor, sir. He was protecting the honor of he and his wife, and he was shot in the chest in 1806. And he was hit, this is my favorite, he was hit in the arm around 1813, by a U.S. senator in a bar fight.
You're kidding me, really?
So this question should have been, who do you want, what U.S. president do you want in a bar fight? And I think Pedro's right. I think you want Andrew Jackson.
Well, who was the senator who shot him?
It was Senator Thomas Hurton Benton.
No way.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. You know, you got to love Andrew Jackson. He no doubt was a huge lover of the Second Amendment, given his love of weaponry. By the way, Rutherford Hayes, another U.S. president, he too was shot 4 times during the Civil War and survived, but he didn't make it into our list. So we had actually quite a few presidents that got shot at all the time.
The 19th century was no time for wimps.
No, it was very Wild West.
All right. Well, Pedro, congratulations. You nailed that question. You nailed it for the right reason, too.
Thank you.
Absolutely. You're going to get a T-shirt. Now, are you going to keep it or are you going to give it to your sweetie pie?
Working on the sweetie pie right now.
Working on the sweetie pie. Well, no doubt the shirt will enhance your sex appeal, so you'll have a sweetie pie before long.
That sounds good.
All right. Well, thanks for playing, Pedro.
Thank you.
Oh, yes. You know, Stuart, I can see that. Wearing that Your Weekly Constitution T-shirt, enhancing your sex appeal, drawing women like flies.
Oh, it happens. Whenever I wear mine, it's just constant.
There's some images that I want to keep to myself. Hey, Stuart, it's the Constitution. You can wear whatever you'd like. I read it. For the articles.
Ending slavery was not the reason a civil war was fought at all. The Civil War was fought to bring the South back into unison with the North and to destroy the economic advantage that the South had had due to slavery. They cared nothing about the lives of black people. They cared nothing about the way that we were treated. They cared nothing about African life.
Capitalism started to rise. But what began to happen was is that in capitalism rising, it began to stifle capitalism because capitalism demands as an economic system that people are always trying to rise to the higher. They're competing. Competition fuels capitalism. But if you could buy an African for $300 and then pay somebody for 20 years $300 a year, which would you do? You'd buy someone one time for $300. But that's going to stifle capitalism, because what's going to happen is that's going to be no competition, because what European is going to compete for a job that they could buy an African to do? So the North said, look, enslavement of African people is stifling capitalism. And so the South says, so what you want me to do? They said, well, you got to free your Africans. They free my Africans. Well, how am I going to get my money? North said, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. They said, we don't trust you. No, we're not going to sell our... We are not going to stop enslaving Africans. We're just not going to do it. North said, but you have to, because it's going to stifle capitalism and we're going to choke with overproduction without an ability to sell what we're... South said, but that's not my problem, because I can sell my raw materials any place in the world. The North said, but then what would happen to us? We have factories. The South said, well, that sounds like a personal problem to me. I don't care what happens to you. North said, but you can't do that. South said, we're going to do that. We're not freeing Africans. They said, you got to free Africa. We're not freeing. In fact, the South said to the North, you know, I'm tired of talking to you. I'm going to secede. I'm not even going to talk to you no more. In fact, I'm not even part of what your colonies are anymore. North said, you can't do that. South said, watch. That started the Civil War.
Every other major country of the world was able to get rid of slavery without a civil war. So the Civil War wasn't fought over slavery. Civil War was fought over unifying and making a strong centralized state. You could have paid for all the slaves and released them. And there were proposals like that. That's the way the British did it. Every major country in the world got rid of slavery without a civil war except us. So it was not necessary. And there were tariffs involved and many other reasons why the Civil War was fought. But if you read Lincoln carefully, you'll realize that Lincoln was not the greatest opponent of slavery. And if you don't look at that, you're denying a very important part of our history.
A new poll out. It's on the anniversary of the Civil War's 150th anniversary. Republicans, 52% of Republicans, say that slavery was not the main reason for the Civil War. Well, so what was the main reason? I mean, in history class, in civil class, etc., teachers give you a lot of different reasons. They say, oh, you know what, there was economic reasons, and they, you know, it was an agriculture-based economy in the South, and it was a manufacturing-based in the North, and blah, 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 right? Yeah, all that stuff is true. It was slavery. Okay, they say, when you ask the Republicans, they say, oh, it was states' rights mainly. Yeah, it was the right of states to own slaves. That was the issue at hand.
For more of my exclusive interview with President Obama, we also got into some issues brewing at home, including that controversy in Virginia over the Confederacy. You might have heard that the Republican governor of that state, Bob McDonnell, named April Confederate History Month, but the proclamation made no mention at all of slavery. So that really sparked a firestorm in the state, which Obama won in 2008.
I'm a big history buff, and I think that understanding the history of the Confederacy and understanding the history of the Civil War is something that every American and every young American should be a part of. Now, I don't think you can understand the Confederacy and the Civil War unless you understand slavery. And so I think that was an unacceptable omission. I think the governor's now acknowledged that. And I think it's just a reminder that when we talk about issues like slavery that are so fraught with pain and emotion, that we better do so thinking through how this is going to affect a lot of people and their sense of whether they're a part of a commonwealth or part of a our broader society.
I'll place my knapsack on my back, my rifle on my shoulder. I'm going away to Shiloh, and there I'll be a soldier.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, and now we're going to continue our conversation with Donnie Kennedy, author of the book The South Was Right, and he's going to tell us what he thinks were the causes of the Civil War. Well, before we leave this, though, now let's grant your point. Let's grant your basic point that there was more than one cause of the Civil War.
Right.
Let's talk, you know, the history is complex, and there are all sorts of conflicts between North and South, and not everybody in the South was a slaveholder. Nonetheless, wasn't slavery the single biggest fundamental difference between North and South, and wasn't it such a big deal, and hadn't it been such a big deal ever since the founding of the nation that of all the various problems, isn't it fair to say that was the primary one that caused the split?
You know, if you mean by that the totality of the issue of slavery, which included my people being afraid of the radical abolitionists attempting, you remember John Brown, you should remember him.
Sure.
The radical abolitionist movement trying to foment a slave rebellion, which would have caused slave insurrection, which would cause the murder of innocent non-slaveholders. John Brown went into Kansas and killed Southerners. He didn't kill Southern slaveholders. He killed Southerners who owned no slaves. So that there was a great fear of how that issue of slavery was being manipulated. So, yes, in that sense, you're probably right. But in the, if you intend to say, oh, because Southerners wanted to maintain slavery and every Southerner wanted to own a slave and, you know, that sort of thing, no, it's not. Again, it's how that issue has been misused.
Well, I don't know if I've ever heard it said by, seriously, that every Southerner owned a slave or every Southerner wanted to own a slave. Certainly, it was a small.
Well, that's hyperbole.
Well,
understand.
It's a small minority of Southerners who were plantation owners or even even slave owners.
According to the figures I have, 6% of Southerners own a deed or a title to a slave. Now, if you include their family, they had the advantage of that title. That would increase to, and this is South-wide, it would be about 20%. And I think there's several different historians who give facts and figures somewhere along those lines. But that still leaves 80% of the Southerners being, as my people were, non-slaveholders.
Mm-hmm. But of all these issues, and serious issues, all these issues and all these differences between North and South, it seems to me that the only one of them that if you took it away, would have meant that there would have been no Civil War, there would have been no secession, is slavery. I don't think any other single issue by itself, if you took it out of the equation, would change the outcome. Is that a fair statement?
I don't doubt you think that away, because you have imbibed 150 years of the victor's propaganda of the war. Period. Hey, wait a minute. Have you ever heard of a professor by the name of Dr. Grady Backwinney? He's the late Dr. Backwinney. He was at TCU, Texas Christian University, Lyndon Baines Johnson's chair of history, well-known, noted Southern historian. He said, quote, "What passes as standard American history is really Yankee history, written by New Englanders or their puppets to glorify Yankee heroes and ideas," end quote. Now, that's not some redneck writer of a book down south. That's a noted Southern historian. And he's not the only one. In our book, The South Was Right, we list one Southern historian after the other from the end of the war until recently who have said the same thing, that Southern history is being undertold, and therefore our own people don't realize the righteousness of their own cause, and they'll end up consigning the South to infamy. And that's what slowly has happened.
Yeah, certainly the victors always write the histories. I think that's a given. Of course, over time, legitimate historians will go back and they'll try to correct for that bias. The problem is, of course, and I think probably a number of people who will be listening have a problem with your statement that the South was right or the South was righteous. And again, it's because of the slavery issue. If you take slavery out of this and we're simply talking about the idea of whether people should be allowed to secede or whether that's a constitutional right, you know, that's one argument. But when you add slavery, it's such a moral outrage that it is today.
But remember, it was not a moral outrage in the 1860s.
Well, I'm going to have to disagree with you. I mean, I understand that we can't judge people in the past by current standards. On the other hand, there had been a long conversation in this country going back to the founding. Just think of the correspondence between Adams and Jefferson, and slaveholders like Jefferson realized how morally wrong slavery was, even as they owned slaves.
Absolutely. And so, see, there's no argument here on that.
Right. The that's, I think, what makes people uncomfortable when we have these discussions is that if we say the South was right or that they had a righteous cause, it seems like a defense of slavery.
Well, it is if you have imbibed for 150 years of the victors' propaganda about why that war was fought. They had to justify, put a fig leaf over the nakedness of their invasion. How else are they going to explain what they did in Atlanta, in Jackson, in Vicksburg, in all those places they went? How are they going to explain?
I have to quibble with you on this. I think you can explain it by simply saying the South started it. They fired on Fort Sumter, right?
Oh, wait. Now, you're so wrong there. International law clearly makes note of the fact it is not the one who fires the first shot who causes the war. It is the one who makes the firing of that shot necessary. If I was an armed man breaking into your home, threatening your wife and children, do you have to wait till I shoot one of your kids before you fire on me?
Well, was Abe Lincoln breaking into the South and going to shoot people?
I do believe there was a contingent of soldiers in the sovereign territory of South Carolina, and there was ships with troops on board. I think there were 8,000 troops on board and four warships headed to Charleston. This fort had to be reduced, or else the South Carolina Charleston, the main harbor in the South at that time, would have been taken over by the federal government.
Well,
and remember, Charleston is in South Carolina. That's a sovereign state.
Well, but it was also part of the United States, or at least certainly Abe Lincoln and the federal government still considered it part of it. I mean,
and the people of South Carolina did not, and the people of the Confederate States did not.
Well, so then they fired the first shots, and so
who made the firing of that shot necessary?
Well, I think that was the same president who was holding out an olive branch to the South, wasn't it?
Olive branch?
I mean, look at Lincoln's first inaugural.
Olive branch in one hand and an axe in another, maybe.
Well, Donnie Kennedy, I sure appreciate your giving us your perspective.
Oh, it's been great fun. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have.
I have enjoyed it immensely. I appreciate your thoughts, and I appreciate your taking the time on this.
My pleasure.
Okay, thank you.
Come see us sometime real soon.
All righty. Bye-bye. My name is Stuart Harris. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we've just finished our discussion with Donnie Kennedy about what caused the Civil War. Now, he had his ideas, but as you might guess, not everyone agrees with him. And after the break, we're going to talk with someone who has a very different impression of what the causes of the Civil War were. His name is James Loewen.
Just before the battle, Mother, I am thinking most of you. While upon the field we're watching, with the enemy in view.
2009 marked the bicentennial of James Madison's presidency and the first inaugural ball. The ball took place at Long's Hotel, one block from the Capitol Building. 400 tickets were sold at $4 apiece. Margaret Bayard Smith, one of Dolly Madison's lifelong friends, described Dolly's entrance. She looked a queen. She had on a pale buff colored velvet dress, made plain, with a very long train but not the least trimming, and beautiful pearl necklace, earrings, and bracelets. Her headdress was a turban of the same colored velvet and white satin from Paris with two superb plumes, the bird of paradise feathers. It would be absolutely impossible for anyone to behave with more perfect propriety than she did. Unassuming dignity, sweetness, grace. It seems to me that such matters would disarm envy itself and conciliate even enemies. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You may have heard of our next guest. He is the best-selling author of the books Lies, My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, and also a book called Lies Across America, both of which challenge the inaccuracies in American history that have been perpetuated even in our school systems. That's how I first heard of James W. Loewen, a sociologist and historian who's taught for many years at the University of Vermont, at Tougaloo College, and most recently at the Catholic University of America. His most recent book, or one of his most recent books, is The Confederate and neo-Confederate reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. Tell us, what caused the American Civil War?
Well, what caused the Civil War was the secession of 11 states from the U.S., of course, beginning with South Carolina, roughly at Christmas Eve of 150 years ago. And so then the question becomes, what caused secession? And
what caused secession, then?
There we go. It's interesting how badly we remember this today. You'd think after 150 years, we could take time to get it right. But we don't. And it's interesting also because the southern states, when they left the Union, beginning with South Carolina, they told us exactly why. And South Carolina says...
You mean they actually put this in writing?
They put it in writing. Here's the document. Here's South Carolina's document, and they were the first. Quote, "Declaration of the immediate causes which induce and justify the secession of South Carolina from the Federal Union," unquote. Kind of the smoking gun, right?
Well, it sort of describes itself, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, and here's what they say. They first of all, spend about two pages giving an unconstitutional constitutional history of the U.S. What I mean by that is, and you might want to use this as a resource in your constitutional law class because it's so bad. they allegedly give kind of a political and constitutional history of the country, but they don't. They talk almost nothing about the Constitution. They emphasize the Articles of Confederation. Well, why wouldn't they? They're, of course, much looser than a Constitution.
Right.
Interestingly, South Carolina was one of the moving forces that pushed for a tighter Constitution, for a tighter and stronger federal government. And in fact, South Carolina's seal, their state seal, then and now, the most important part of it is a palmetto tree, standing, of course, for the state of South Carolina, surrounded by 12 pikes. Of course, they stand for the other 12 colonies,
right,
tied together to form a fasces. Some of your listeners won't know that if you lash 13 twigs together with string, you wind up with a strong stick that you could beat somebody with. And that's where we get, in fact, the term fascist and fascism, kind of in unity there is strength or something.
Okay.
And the South Carolina state seal not only shows this fasces, but it has them tied together with a banner that says, "Quis separabit," or "Who shall separate us?" Well, this whole kind of thinking, of course, played no role in 1860 and 61, so they ignore all that. But after this kind of unconstitutional constitutional history, then they get down to the matter at hand, which is, why are they seceding? And here's what they say, and I'm going to quote it exactly. This, incidentally, is from my new book, The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader. We're going to discover in this conversation, most people across the U.S., and not just in the South at all, get secession exactly 180 degrees wrong. And they've been teaching it that way to K-12 students in North Dakota, in Southern Florida, in Southern California, in Cleveland. These are places where I've asked, each of those places where I've asked at least scores and sometimes hundreds of teachers, why did the South secede?
And they get it wrong.
Let's listen to what they say. Here's what they say. Quote, "We assert that 14 of the states have deliberately refused for years past to fulfill their constitutional obligations, and we refer to their own statutes for the proof." Now, constitutional obligation sounds a bit vague, but they go right on to tell us what they mean. They say, "The Constitution of the United States, in its fourth article, provides as follows, quote, 'No person held to service or labor in one state, under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due.'"
Ah, the Fugitive Slave
That's
Clause.
That's the Fugitive Slave Clause, and it begins to look like maybe slavery has something to do with it. What teachers across the United States are teaching, some 65% of them on average, is states' rights. Well, ironically, states' rights is, as I mentioned, 180 degrees wrong, and the South Carolina Declaration goes on to explain this. They even list the states and the rights that upset them. They are against states' rights. And here's what they say. The states of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, blah, 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 they list a bunch of states ending up in Wisconsin and Iowa, have enacted laws which either nullify the acts of Congress or render useless any attempt to execute them. In many of these states, the fugitive is discharged from the... So they're still going on about the Fugitive Slave Act. They also criticize, for example, New York State, because New York State no longer allows temporary slavery. This was the system whereby, well, let's suppose you're a rich planter from Charleston, South Carolina. You don't want to spend August in Charleston. In fact, I spent part of last August in Charleston. I understand that.
That's tough.
Yeah. So you'd rather see some Broadway plays, maybe. But you don't want to do your own cooking. You want to bring your cook along. Well, New York now says, well, no, we're running a free state here. If you bring your slave into New York, she becomes free. Well, South Carolina is outraged at this, and they say so. And they're outraged, for example, at New Hampshire, because New Hampshire lets blacks vote. Well, now, who votes in America is a state's right until two whole eras after this, during Reconstruction, when we passed the 15th Amendment. But nevertheless, South Carolina takes it upon itself to lambast New England states for letting blacks vote. In short, they are against states' rights. They are outraged at states' rights, and they list the states and the rights that outrage them.
Now, this is remarkable, and so let's pause and make sure we've got this all straight. The northern states, at least the ones that South Carolina mentioned, they're free states, and they don't want people to be able to bring slaves in there and essentially have slavery within their boundaries, and so they have been resisting the Fugitive Slave Clause, and they've been resisting federal statutes that try to enforce the Fugitive Slave Clause. And it's this insistence that they have the right to be free and to run their states the way they want to run them. It's those states' rights that have incensed South Carolina and made it wish to secede.
That's right.
That is remarkable. That's a story that rarely gets told in American schools.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, we just not only that, we tell the exact opposite. Let me read you from one other document. This is Mississippi, which seceded exactly a month after South Carolina. And when they go to, they use the same title. They steal the title. They say, quote, a declaration of the immediate causes which induce and justify the secession of the state of Mississippi from the Federal Union. Well, it worked for South Carolina. Why not? And here's what they say, quote, our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest of the world. Its labor supplies the product which contributes by far the largest and most important portions of the commerce of the earth. And they go on to say, a blow at slavery is a blow at commerce and civilization. So they couldn't be clearer either. It's all about slavery. It is not about states' rights.
You know, that's remarkable. That declaration goes beyond what South Carolina said in the language you quoted. In fact, this seems reminiscent of that famous statement by John C. Calhoun that slavery is a positive good.
Oh, absolutely. And that's South Carolina, incidentally, equals Mississippi. I just didn't read it all. But another thing that upsets South Carolina is that the northern states allow agitation about whether or not slavery should be done away with. In other words, they allow abolitionist societies to exist. Well, of course, it turned out that back then, even in places like Boston, abolitionist societies were so controversial that white racist Democrats, the Democratic Party was pretty much the party of white supremacy throughout the 19th century and called itself the White Man's Party, they would break up abolitionist meetings and stuff. But, of course, they didn't always break them up, and these societies did exist. And their mere existence is one of the reasons that South Carolina says they are seceding.
So, in other words, another reason South Carolina is seceding is because it's against free speech.
Yes.
You know, that's remarkable, too. And, in fact, something that's often overlooked is to what extent the southern states were taking on many of the trappings of police states during the period leading up to the Civil War, because you couldn't even publish or send through the mails abolitionist literature on pain, I think, of prison in many states.
Well, by the time of the winter of 1860, and even before South Carolina secedes, but the winter of 18, even the late fall after Lincoln's election, it wasn't safe to be a northern tourist in South Carolina. You might literally get beaten up, literally be forced to leave the state.
Wow.
You had to prove you were sound on slavery, and how are you going to do that?
Good heavens.
So anyway, it was all about slavery. It's all about the S word. It's not about states' rights. It's also not about tariffs and taxes. Now, about 20% of teachers across America are teaching that it's because of tariffs and taxes. Well, it turns out that at the time South Carolina seceded, in fact, at the time the seven Deep South states seceded, that was all before Lincoln took office. And during that time, the tariff had been written by a Virginian in 1854. All of the congressional delegation from South Carolina had voted in favor of it. And it was, in fact, the lowest tariff the U.S. had ever had, or probably the lowest, certainly the lowest since the War of 1812. So nobody in South Carolina had any complaints about the tariff.
You know, I've actually wondered about
almost
that.
Almost none of the southern states say anything about tariffs and taxes when they leave the Union because it's not the issue.
It's no longer a big issue at all. In fact, if I recall correctly, that had been the issue, or at least supposedly the issue, during the secession crisis of the 1830s.
Yeah, and 1831 to 32.
And that had pretty much been resolved during the 1830s.
Yeah, we dropped the tariff and accommodated the South. So it wasn't an issue. So the only when I ask this question across the U.S., why did the South leave the Union? I get four answers. The four answers are over slavery, for states' rights, tariffs and taxes, or the election of Lincoln. Now, only about 2% of my audiences actually vote for the election of Lincoln. But it turns out that's a right answer, too. It's not an underlying cause like these others. It's more a trigger. But South Carolina does complain, and so do the other states when they leave the Union, about the election of Lincoln. They call him a black Republican. So why are they against him? Well, it all comes back to slavery, because, of course, he's against slavery. So the election of Lincoln would be a good, an okay answer, but only 2% of... I've given this kind of referendum, if you will, to over 3,000 or 4,000 teachers in the last 5 years. And I got to tell you, 60 to 75% of them say states' rights. And then there's a group that gets it even worse. I've asked several big groups of people who run historic sites, like the American Association for State and Local History. I've asked them, why did the South leave the Union? 80% of them say states' rights. And so these are the people who run historical societies across the southern states, but also across the northern states. It's not just the South getting this wrong.
Well, you know, Jim, I have to interject here that even if one grants the southern perspective to a limited extent, that there was a states' rights issue from their perspective, it's a states' right to do what? And that would be, of course, to have slavery. So even if one grants that premise, it ultimately is pretty much all about slavery.
Well, it is. But you see, the reason I'm not going to grant even that premise is not because I'm harsh or recalcitrant or anything like that, but it turns out that the federal government was doing nothing whatsoever against slavery. It was under the federal government was under the thumb of the Buchanan administration, and James Buchanan, this is an interesting little sideline, James Buchanan was, as far as I know, our only, for sure, gay president. And I even out him in my book, Lies Across America.
Right.
And the reason this is relevant is because for many years in Washington, he lived with his gay partner and companion, William Rufus King, who was a slave owner from Alabama and senator from Alabama and briefly vice president in the administration of Buchanan's predecessor, the Pierce administration. And Buchanan looked up to King, and I think that's why he became a member of the far-out pro-slavery wing of the Democratic Party. My point being, then, that in no way was South Carolina or any other southern state upset at all about federal policy or the federal government. In no way was it trying to maintain states' rights against the federal government in 1860 when it seceded. It was happy as a clam with the federal government under Buchanan, and so the states' rights answer, you can't even really give it even that, I think. You can maybe say, well, they seceded for the states' right to secede. But that, of course, is tautological and circular and says the same thing twice.
Right. Very interesting. So to summarize, if we want to know why the South seceded, which, of course, caused the war, then we look to the southern states themselves, and they have told us in black and white why they seceded, and it all comes down to slavery.
That's right.
Well, that is, of course, a great revelation to many people in this day and age. To what do you attribute this rewriting of history?
Well, around 1890, we as a country entered into what historians call the Nader. Some people pronounce that word Nadir, and I think that both is okay. The N-A-D-I-R, the Nader of race relations.
The lowest point in race
relations. Yeah, Nader means low point, exactly, the opposite of zenith. Well, the reason we call it the low point of race relations is because during this era, 1890 to maybe 1940, white folks, the white ideology in America, went more racist than at any other point, more racist even than during slavery. And, of course, furthermore, things were getting worse year by year, which they were not, let's say, in 1860 or 1865. I'm not trying to claim that it was worse to be black in America in Mississippi in 1859 than it was in 1919. I'm not saying that. But even in 1859, no white person could really tell himself or herself in their heart of hearts that slavery was an upward mobility system, and black folks just weren't very smart, and that's why they weren't making it out of slavery. Mm-hmm. I mean, there simply was almost no way out of slavery. Sally Hemings, to the contrary, and a few slaves who managed to work in industry and buy their freedom or something like that, it was almost impossible to get out of slavery, and it was getting more and more impossible as the 1850s progressed. So slavery was not a fair system. But in 1900... white folks could tell themselves, and we did, I speak as a white folk, that, you know, those black folks are still on the bottom. They're on the bottom in Columbus, Ohio, or in Peterborough, New Hampshire, or in Charleston, South Carolina, wherever I am. And why is that? We can't blame slavery anymore because they're one, maybe two generations out of slavery. So it must be their own fault. And that was the ideology that swept the country. And it particularly swept the country beginning in 1890, because of three events that happened that year, late in that year. One of them was what we used to call the Battle of Wounded Knee, but now it's more accurately known as the Massacre at Wounded Knee. And when we took away the last shards of independence from the last Western Indians and Native Americans sink into their nadir for darn sure. It might be interesting to your listeners, not one person called the Civil War the war between the states when it was going on. When it was going on, it was called the Civil War. Duh. This is a later development.
Why do you know? Why particularly was that title adopted, War Between the States?
Oh, because, of course, that implies that it's a batch of equal states that just went to get to war with each other. You know, I guess Virginia with New Hampshire and North Carolina, whatever. I mean, I'm being a little
rather than
about
acknowledging
it.
That this was a rebellion by some states against the federal government.
Yeah. And in fact, some neo-Confederates have even got a whole ideology going as to why it's improper to call it a civil war, because the South did not try to take over the administration of the entire country. Well, that's not the definition of a civil war. You can look it up. And this, of course, was a civil war and should be called that, because that's what it was called. I mean, you can't just make your own name up for something. You have to call it what it was called.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to James Lowen for sharing with us all of his research from the Confederate and Neo-Confederate reader. Thanks also to Donnie Kennedy, author of The South Was Right. It's an ongoing debate, and I bet in another 150 years they'll still be talking about it. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.